There's a classic silent film that shows a rocket zooming toward the man in the moon. Hits him smack in the eye. That was early science fiction. Well, this morning, NASA did something a little bit like that. It smashed an empty rocket into a cold, dark lunar crater near the moon's south pole. The goal was to kick up evidence of water in the form of ice, as NPR's Neil Greenfield Boyce reports.
Moments before, the big rocket part crashed into a lunar crater at more than 5,000 miles per hour. Flight director Rusty Hunt asked his team at NASA's Ames Research Center in California if they were ready for the impact.
Payloader, you go. Go, flight. Science.
Go.
As the chunk of rocket hurtled down towards the lunar surface, another spacecraft followed. Its cameras and science instruments were sending images and data back to Earth. NASA showed this footage live on the internet. You could see gray craters slowly coming closer and closer until the big target crater, Cabeus, filled the screen with black shadows hiding its floor.
All stations, flight. Mark Centaur impact.
But when the rocket hit, the footage didn't show a big explosion. The images just got fuzzy and disappeared. As planned, the observation spacecraft had crashed a few minutes after the first impact. All around the country, people had gathered to watch NASA sock it to the moon. At the museum in Washington, D.C., NASA officials and people off the street viewed the footage on a big screen. John Glowacki of McLean, Virginia, had come with his daughter and young son, who was wearing a spacesuit costume. Glowacki said the crash didn't look quite like he expected.
I was waiting for the plume, actually, but I guess that comes later. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
The impact was expected to send a huge cloud of debris miles up above the crater's rim, but initial images didn't show that. At a press conference, mission managers said maybe the plume just didn't rise as high as they expected or was at an angle.
I guess I'm not necessarily surprised because I knew I would be surprised, if that makes any sense. I knew we were going someplace that to expect what you're not going to expect.
Anthony Colapriet is the project scientist for this mission, which is called LCROSS, for Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. His team said images were still being processed from the spacecraft and telescopes that were watching the crash. We'll be putting the latest pictures up at NPR.org. Colapriet says they already know enough to say the mission was successful.
I can certainly report there was an impact. We saw the impact. We saw the crater. And we got good measurements, spectroscopic measurements, which is what we needed, of the impact event.
He says it looks like they'll have the data they need to answer the question, is water hidden inside the moon's darkest, coldest craters? He said it'll be a while before they make any announcements, but reporters pressed Colapriet to say if any early signs of water had been found. One reporter asked if he would know if water is there later in the day.
I probably will, but I'm not going to tell you.
He says his team has to study the new information thoroughly.
We just got to sit back and be careful. We don't want to, again, life is full of surprises. We want to be careful not make a false negative or a false positive claim.
Knowing if water is in the craters, and if so, how much, would be scientifically interesting as well as potentially useful as NASA plans future exploration efforts. Colapriet said his team would be working feverishly. But first, they were going to get some sleep. They've been up all night, getting ready for their brief 1-2 punch to the moon. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Pending legislation on a climate plan includes a lot of escape clauses designed to ease the pain for industry and consumers. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The model so far for curbing greenhouse gases is the cap-and-trade approach. It works through permits. Think of them as sort of like poker chips. The government gives or sells permits to, say, power companies. A company cashes in a chip when it emits a ton of greenhouse gas. Use up your pile of permits and you've got to buy more. If you don't need all of them, you can sell the extras to another player. Many industries are saying, okay, we can live with that if we can have offsets, too. Offsets are like an extra pile of poker chips that companies can buy at a discount. Michael Wara is an economist at Stanford University who studies offsets.
They induce countries, governments, companies, individuals who are otherwise reluctant to do something about climate change to to do something about it because it's in their financial interest. They draw people in.
Let's say you run a power company and you just can't live within your emissions cap. Well, you can pay someone else to reduce their emissions. That could be cheaper than rebuilding your own power plant to emit less carbon dioxide. European companies have been doing this for years. They pay China, for example, to build hydroelectric dams instead of coal plants, or they pay farmers to capture methane from hog waste instead of letting it float up into the atmosphere. But offsets make some people suspicious. They ask how many of these projects really deliver the emission reductions they promise.
The honest answer is we don't know.
Michael Wara again.
They've proven to be very difficult to administer effectively in a way that ensures that they lead to real reductions in emissions.
Here's one of the problems. Let's say a Chinese power company needs a new power plant. They can build a coal plant, which is cheap, or they can build a wind farm, which costs more. If they choose the wind farm, though, they can earn credits they can sell on the offset market. The idea is that money from polluters will pay for additional green projects that wouldn't have been built otherwise. Trouble is, says Wara, China probably would have built most of those wind farms anyway without the offset money.
China's building a lot of wind farms. All of the wind farms that are being built claim credit as offset projects. And so the question is, would none of those have been built if the offset system didn't exist? I think the real answer is that that can't be right.
The group International Rivers concludes that it's the same with dams. Most have earned offset credits in China, but many would have been built anyway. Europeans are now rethinking their whole offset scheme, but the proposed climate bill in Congress would introduce much the same system here. In fact, the bill allows American industry to buy as much as 2 billion tons of greenhouse gas offset credits. Many of those credits are likely to come from American forests. Trees suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and America has lots of them. But that raises another different problem, something called permanence. Alexia Kelly is a climate analyst with the World Resources Institute in Washington. She supports offsets, but
forests can burn down. They can be prematurely or illegally harvested. We can have a pest or disease outbreak that can kill the biological matter and re-release the carbon. There's a lot of things that can happen.
One way to handle the risk, she says, is to make companies buy extra offset credits, something like insurance, in case their forest goes up in smoke. Kelly acknowledges that an honest offset scheme will take a lot of people and a lot of vigilance.
Are we going to get it completely right all the time? No. But I think that we can ensure that projects that do deserve credit are getting them.
In California, an organization called the Climate Action Reserve has taken the plunge. It's brokering deals between timber owners and polluting companies that want to buy offsets now. Gary Jarrow runs the reserve.
We've gone from, in the last year, 6 projects to 100 projects, and I think it can go to thousands of projects.
Jarrow says the reserve uses a tougher standard than the Kyoto system to make sure offset projects are the real McCoy. Ultimately, says Stanford's Michael Wara, offsets are probably in the cards no matter what.
There's a political compromise in the U.S. that's been drawn between environmental groups and big emitters of greenhouse gases.
That compromise is that to win deep cuts in emissions, Congress has to offer more cheap poker chips to get the game going. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
It takes about half a second to turn something we think into something we say. Scientists have been studying just what happens in our brains during that half second, and there's a lot of activity found in the part of the brain that's the subject of our next report. It's a part of the brain called Broca's area. Now, after more than a century of effort, scientists have found some clues to what happens there. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
A lot of what we know about how speech works in the brain comes from a French doctor in the 19th century. His name was Pierre-Paul Broca.
He had 2 patients, and they both had a very strange pattern of mental problems.
Ned Sahin is a researcher at UC San Diego and Harvard University. Sahin has spent a lot of time pondering Dr. Broca and his 2 famous patients.
They were aware of their situations. They could see and hear. They can even understand what people were asking them, but they couldn't answer back.
Broca suspected brain damage, so after his patients died, he took a look.
The patients both had holes in the brain, and they were in roughly the same area. And so that area became known as Broca's area.
It lies just beneath your left temple. Somehow, this part of the brain helps us speak. But scientists haven't learned much more than that, despite lots of autopsies and studies using high-tech brain scans. What they needed was a way to directly monitor the cells in Broca's area in real time. Sahin says you can do that, but you have to put wires into a person's brain.
And humans don't like wires in their head.
So Broca's area remained a mystery until Sahin and a team of researchers came across three very cooperative patients with epilepsy. All three were going to get surgery to remove some of the brain tissue causing their seizures. To plan that surgery, doctors had put dozens of electrodes in their brains. Sahin says the three patients agreed to play a sort of word game on a computer while they were wired up but still conscious.
So, for instance, they might see the word walk and then the sentence frame, every day they with a blank, or yesterday they with a blank. And the job was to say the form of the word that was correct for that blank.
Meanwhile, the scientists monitored what was happening in Broca's area and precisely when it happened. Sahin says at 200 milliseconds, that's 2/10 of a second after seeing the words, a spike in brain activity suggested they were figuring out what the words meant.
At 320 milliseconds, we saw evidence of grammatical processing. And then at 450 milliseconds, we saw processing for the sound form of the word, queuing up what exactly to say and getting ready to say it.
The results show that Broca's area is involved in several major processes related to speech. Nina Dronkers works at the VA's Northern California healthcare system and treats patients who have language problems caused by brain damage. She says the new study supports what a lot of researchers already suspected.
More and more, we're thinking of Broca's area as a region that can do many different things. And the nice thing about this study is that it shows that even these different functions can emerge within an extremely short time frame.
Dronkers is also intrigued by the study's finding that brain cells working on grammar, for example, seem to be in almost the same place as cells working on comprehension or speech production.
So they might serve one function at one point in time and another function at another point in time.
Scientists think Broca's area probably isn't limited to speech. It may help us process music as well. The new study appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Traffic noise and other sounds of city life have taken the romance away for Australia's urban frogs. Air conditioners, jackhammers, generators, they're all drowning out the mating calls of male frogs. And as a result, frog populations are plummeting in the country's urban areas. But there's hope, at least according to a scientist at the University of Melbourne. She says some frogs have figured out a way to work around the human interference in their love lives. From Sydney, Stuart Cohen has the story.
That's the sound of a male southern brown tree frog looking for a date. It's music to the ears of a female southern brown tree frog. But add the sounds of nearby traffic. And Dr. Kirsten Paris of the University of Melbourne says the message just isn't getting out.
The distance over which a male frog can be heard is cut really dramatically by traffic noise, from hundreds of metres in some instances down to maybe only 20 or 50 metres. We're quite concerned that there are frogs out there that aren't getting together because the noise we're making is getting in the way.
So some frogs have come up with an interesting strategy for making themselves heard.
We found that it's changing the pitch of its call, so going higher up the frequency spectrum, being higher and squeakier, further away from the traffic noise, and this increases the distance over which it can be heard.
Here's the old call. And here's the new one. Now that may sound like a pretty simple solution, but changing their calls to cope with the noisy environment is actually quite extraordinary for frogs. And while the males have figured out how to make themselves heard above the noise of the city, Dr. Paris says it may not be what the females are looking for.
When females have a choice between two males calling, they tend to select the one that calls at a lower frequency because in frogs, the frequency of a call is related to body size, so the bigger frogs tend to call lower. And so they also tend to be the older frogs, the guys, perhaps with more experience, they know what they're doing, and the women are attracted to those.
In other words, the high talkers typically don't get the girls.
That's right, and if it's very noisy, they can only hear a few of the males that are all calling in a group, so the ones they can choose from, the number is reduced. It's like if you're in a noisy cocktail bar, for example, and there are men everywhere, you can only see and hear the three that are closest to you. You either choose to go with one of them, or you spend more energy going to search the room to find someone who looks a little bit more promising. And for females, the longer the time they spend hopping around looking for mates, the more time they're exposed to predators and the more energy they use. So there's a cost to spending a lot of time searching for mates.
Frog populations in Melbourne have dropped considerably in the 7 years since Dr. Paris began her research. It's not just noise that's been the culprit. Climate change has brought a decade of drought to parts of Australia. Since frogs often serve as the environmental canary in a coal mine, Dr. Paris says their demise is worth paying attention to.
Urban habitats are expanding very quickly. At the moment, they only cover about 4% of the Earth's terrestrial surface. And I think the fact that frogs and other animals that communicate acoustically, such as birds, are struggling in urban habitats shows us that the urban habitat is not a healthy place for people either. Noisy places tend to lead to higher stress levels amongst people, a difficulty sleeping, and the quality of life is reduced.
For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
Take all my money, treat me like a child.